Hey, I'm going to follow from the talk I gave on Monday, and basically, this being a meeting organized for children, so I somehow kept the focus on that more so than immunology, much as I'd like to talk some of the mechanisms. But I thought this is also a great opportunity to really go into some immunological mechanisms and how they manifest in different ways. Taking care of a disease, not taking care of a disease, vaccine failure or success, drug resistance. These are all manifestations of the same broad mechanisms. And understanding the integration and the interconnection is also, I find very attractive. So here, in this talk, my contributors, I call contributors more than collaborators, because some of the collaborators don't contribute. And they are Stephanie Portek from University of Manitoba, who has done lots of mathematics. And Neil Madras, you heard the talk yesterday. Some of the diagrams are shared and some of the ideas are shared. And of course, Marie Alexander in Winnipeg, he has done lots of modeling work of all sorts. So basically, as I'll remind you that on Monday, I brought this slide to bring point that there are some essential requirements of drug resistance, that a pathogen must replicate, and introduction of mutations through either error proneness or polymerase or some recombination, and there has to be a selection pressure, but not necessarily if the mutated pathogen has a very high fitness, has a much better fitness than the wild type. So the case in point in 2007, emergence of oseltamivir-resistant H3N2 in South Africa without the drug. So selection, pressure is not obligatory. And with that said, I like to bring, I like to bring a point here, just as this is most people know, but I still like to make, differentiate between emergence and spread of drug resistance. And why I bring this up, because oftentimes modeling community has not distinguished the two. And I've seen many, many models where a spread and emergence have been kind of fused and not separated well enough. And these are, of course, as you know, emergence is an individual process affected by virus replication rate, virus mutation rate, and selection pressure if less fit virus is emerging. Whereas a spread occurs in a population and it is governed by host interconnectedness, pre-existing cross immunity to that, and replication fitness of the resistant virus. Of course, you would need a typical epidemic model to handle this. Here, we would need more in-host models to handle this. With that said, this talk is all about in this domain. And basically, once again, this slide I showed the other day, and mutation, how they're handled. Actually, mutation is a very important source of development of resistance and all immunological failures, but I'll provide evidence that how these are managed by the immune system. These are actually very meticulously managed by the immune system. Here is a simple that any time any polymerase from viruses all the way to human, there's a polymerase involved in duplication of genome, and sometimes that polymerase, especially in case of viruses, don't have a proofreader, but most of this, there's a proofreader. So if there's no proofreader, of course, there's a lot of error made by all polymerases, regardless of the source of it. And if there's a proofreader corrects most of these mistakes, but not all of it. Some are still left, And that's the basis of our evolution, continued evolution. So now, this nucleic acid is of course translated through mRNA and into protein, and not all mutations lead to amino acid change. If they're not changing amino acid, then it's called a symmetric mutation, and if they do cause an amino acid change, it's called non-symmetric. The ratio of the two it's a very important measure of selection process, whereas in fact most times a asymmetric mutation leads to extinction of the virus. And I'll give you a very good example here. This is for last, actually I missed writing the reference for this work. It was published a few years ago. That's for 24 years of influenza A virus sequences that affect human, those H1N1, H2N2, and H3N2, where this DN by DS ratio that which I mentioned here was actually used to study the natural selection of the amino acid sequence in the 11 proteins of influenza A virus. And most interestingly, you can see that these regions, because if the ratio is more than one, these are preferred, these are positively selected changes. In fact, there are very little changes in a span of 24 years in so many proteins of the influenza virus. You see sufficient changes in HA, NA region, and NS1, but very little in polymerase genes, and of course. So despite all the mutability, most of the mutations don't actually make it. They cause extinction of the virus, or they are negatively selected, and they are competed out by those which are more fit. So mutation is not always the bad news, you know, because there's a lot of selection going on here. So now here is I just listed a ballpark error rates of various polymerases. And so for example, viral polymerase lacking proofreader, which is RNA-dependent DNA polymerase, HIV reverse transcriptase is an example. But see here, we know HIV reverse transcriptase does lots of error, and of course, some people attribute that's the reason immune system is not able to control the virus, and that's the reason drug resistance emerges. But this is not all quite true. Why? Here's an example. Some of you heard this talk by Alyssa Schwartz the other day, and she mentioned about another retrovirus, which is equine encephalitis virus. It was EIA, right? Yeah, okay. And that virus also has a reverse transcriptase with similar error rate, by the way. And it's very well controlled by the immune system. Also, HTLV1 and 2 also have reverse transcriptase. These are retroviruses. These they don't produce as quickly the drug resistance as HIV produces. So there's more to this story than just the mutation by the virus. And of course, the other RNA-dependent RNA viruses, like in flu virus and hepatitis C virus, they also make an error, some three times less than what influenza, what RT does, just transcriptase does. Whereas viral polymerase with proofreaders, such as in herpes viruses, they make much less error. And of course, unlike HIV, flu and HCV patients develop drug resistance, or only some patient develop resistance, even when there's a monotherapy. In case of HIV, virtually everybody develops drug resistance. And we'll analyze what it means, actually. So DNA-dependent DNA polymerase, in this case, very rarely you see emergence of drug resistance. Example being herpes viruses like HSV and CMV. Then, of course, to contrast with bacterial and human polymerases with proofreader, the error rate is again about a log apart. With that said, I want to go into some, I picked four examples for the sake of time, saving time, and try to show you how immune response or an immune system is involved in development or prevention of development of resistance. So example here, we'll first go through HSV, herpes simplex virus, and here of course a very classic drug is acyclovir. Acyclovir is actually an analog, a nucleic acid analog, which inhibits virus thymidine kinase, and this enzyme is needed to phosphorylate this analog to monophosphate. And once it is phosphorylated, cellular kinases bring it to triphosphate level, which is now ready to be incorporated into DNA. But this analog actually inhibits the HSV DNA polymerase. So there are two steps of inhibition in this. And what happens? There is an extensive use of this drug. So here's a graph that I copied from a review. In the 10 years from 1990 to 2000, there has been constant increase, and actually the new data shows even much larger increase. It so happens that around that time, 98, a paper appeared by Sari Blower and others, and another 2 years later by, these are two modeling papers by Lipschick and others. And what this paper indicated, these are very prominent papers. What the paper indicated that HSV2, there are only 10% of the patients are treated who receive treatment. And the idea was put in this paper that not to increase the level of treatment because that will lead to rampant increase in resistance. But actually, and similar, not exactly the same, but similar conclusions came from this paper. But it turns out none of them proved to be true. And here is an example that this review article shows that in different studies, immunocompetent and immunocompromised people were examined for the level of drug resistance development. And it was found that there is almost a log difference in the level of, in the prevalence of drug resistance. Immunocompromised people showed much more emergence of resistance than immunocompetent people. And of course, there are lots of references I have arranged in this. And in fact, there are about half a dozen studies which have measured and shown that over a period of two decades or so, there is no change in the resistance pattern despite an increasing use of the drug. I particularly mentioned this paper. This is a paper from Quebec, with Guy being an author in that paper. And it's a very nice paper. Very nicely describes one of the early papers to show that the resistance is essentially largely confined to immunocompromised people. So this is one example I showed you. Another, most of us here, because most of the people here work on influenza, so people know. So I just point-wise mentioned that without including the references. So amantadine and oseltamivir resistance in influenza virus. You know, amantadine has been a drug used for a long time, very successfully, and didn't lead to any resistance until a few years ago from some unknown source emergence. The resistance emerged, and it is widespread now. All strains of influenza virus have this resistance. And until 2007, there were sporadic occurrences of oseltamivir resistance. But then a drug-independent emergence of resistance appeared in South Africa. So what I'm trying to point here is that it is not the error rate alone. There are other factors which are affecting quite a bit. And these drugs, despite the error rate of the virus, have been very successfully used in humans, in immunocompetent people. Now, rapid emergence of oseltamivir resistance now is being found in H1N strain. And here is something interesting, that there are lots, until March 5, 2010, there are 264 cases of oseltamivir resistant pandemic influenza, 2009 pandemic influenza cases reported. And virtually, in fact, it turns out almost similar number of papers have been published on drug resistance in influenza as a number of cases. And in fact, no paper had predicted that this level of resistance will be seen. Always there will be much higher resistance was predicted. And that affected the stockpiling policies, of drug stockpiling policies. Now, and here, and of course, most of sulfamidin resistant, and there are lots of papers now. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, EID and there are whole other journals, there are several articles appearing that most of the cases of resistance were essentially confined to immunocompromised people. So basically, it again shows that immune status has to do something with the management of resistance. Of course, the classic case of HIV, we all know that resistance develops very quickly if you have monotherapy, which was going on for a long time, and of course, when the triple combination therapy began since 1996, the resistance became infrequent to rare, and of course, these regimes were expanded by addition of integrase and fusion inhibitors. So, in this case, of course, the virus itself generates causes lots of immunodeficiency. And so, then I have also put briefly for hepatitis B. And in this case, there's a particular mutation in the polymerase, which is tyrosine, methionine, aspartate. Motif, there's a mutation in that leads to resistance. This resistance actually begins to be seen some 40 weeks after 3TC treatment. And of course, it is always usually found in immunocompromised people, but also found in immunocompetent people. Okay. So here, based upon all these things, I put a little table that rapid and frequent emergence of antiviral resistance during HIV infection or immunosuppressive therapy. In fact, I cite this five examples of the viral infection, and you will see that what is remarkable is in case of HIV, almost everybody who gets monotherapy develops resistance in 3 months or so. Whereas in case of all these viruses, very infrequent development of resistance in immunocompetent people, but a frequent emergence of resistance in immunocompromised people. So again, these are all to point you, to provide you epidemiological evidence of association between immune response and or immune status and the development of resistance. Now the question is, how does the immune system control the emergence of antiviral resistance? And so now, in short, the answer is by blocking infection, so no replication, pathogen must replicate, or by killing the infected cell. Now, anytime there is an infection, it means the neutralizing antibodies were either adequate or were not there, infection takes place, and this is a classical slide where a pathogen introduced first time multiplies with interference by the innate immunity, and of course there's the CTL, oligonucleal CTLs induced, and neutralizing antibodies induced, and pathogen is suppressed in time. This is true for most viruses if they are controlled by the immune system. Viruses which are not controlled by the immune system, like HIV and like HCV, this will not be true. And here the point I'm trying to make here is that if you bring the virus second time around, of course there is a much more CTL response and neutralizing antibody response. So if these antibodies are already present, they are blocking any infection to go on. So of course, in that case, they will prevent any new development of resistance. But the second, which is a very important manner in which these viruses, immune response controls the emergence of resistance, is by killing the infected cell. In fact, Marie Alexander gave a talk 2 days ago on this, so I'll just briefly mention that the rate of death of infected cell is a very important parameter by which immune system manages to control the spread of infection. Whether you recover or not is determined by the rate of death of infected cell. And this death occurs by one of the three, there are three ways for that to happen. So this is two of them are associated with the innate immune response to infection. And once the virus itself, this is a virus, binds to target cell, infects, and after some time it produces virus, it is productive. And then after a certain amount of virus application, the cell's resources are exhausted and cell dies. So this is death one. The other is that NK cell in the whole innate process, NK cells are activated and they can also kill at this stage, which is death two. Okay. Then of course, this whole process primes the immune system, primes and develops this dendritic cells or antigen presenting cells, which of course cause development of adaptive immunity, which begins with T cell response. Okay. And of course, here what this cartoon shows is a single naive cell specificity responding to this antigen presenting cell, and there's an amplification. A portion of this will go into memory, and some of this will be differentiating into cytotoxic T cells as an effector cells, and will kill this infected cell. Now, these processes have been modeled extensively by Marie Alexander in some great detail. So here, in any virus infection, this is one example. Like that, there is usually an oligoclonal, polyclonal CTL formation. So there are many clones, anywhere from 2 to 20 or 25 T cell expressors will be going through the same process. And as a result, here is what happens. And you've seen this slide yesterday. So basically, here is a target cell infected by wild type virus, where I've taken here, it has six different CTL recognizable epitope. One of them is absent in this individual. Okay. And of course, any one of this can mutate. In one set, I've divided them into five groups, depending on what combination of mutations occur, or in any two mutations, any three mutations, any four, and all of them. And so, very simply, that if you have any two CTLs, any two specificity of CTLs present in adequate amounts are enough to wipe out all of these cells. Like that, any three so will wipe out all of these cells, and so on. If you have all of these mutations occurred, then of course this cell will escape the CTL point. The point here is that if you compute the error rates are so low that you actually, it's impossible to reach this level of mutation in the time in real life. So basically, what happens that this is also applicable to drug resistance problem. Drug resistance and CTL escape are not inseparable events. Any genetic change that happens in a genome, so long as the cell is recognizable by a CTL, it leads to a CTL cage formation. Basically, so here is an infected cell. It is surrounded by CTLs of different specificity recognizing different epitopes. This CTL cage makes it virtually very difficult for a cell to escape that. And actually, we are actively from these talks and discussion, we are actively trying to define conditions in which such escape will occur. And I'll just come to you in a minute how this escape occurs, and actually probably it does occur. But so if any mutation in the virus occurs, so long as any recognizable CTL epitopes exist, that cell will be killed. So this is a major, major mechanism by which antiviral immune response prevents propagation of drug-resistant mutants. Here, I've listed some conditions which we are actually testing through models. Under what conditions optimal CTL response will not occur and promote drug resistance. So impaired T cell activation, some of that happens among the elderly or those with pre-existing hypercytopenemia. Inhibition of CTL response or TH1 response by increasing TH2 response, such as in pregnant women. Progressive loss of CTL oligoclonal due to clonal competition. This we believe is probably a very important contributor, that one clone multiplies faster than the other, and consequently you have a dominance of one clone, and progressively the other clone diminishes. Consequently, you diminish your oligochronology. And so these are actually part of mathematical modeling which Stephanie has done, sorry. And of course, diminution of diversity of T cell repertoire resulting from chronic infection like CMV or HIV. And lastly, but not the least, infection-induced death of T cells. We discovered that in case of HIV, but this is not unique to HIV. There are other infections which lead to death of CTLs. Okay, and so basically, what happens, whether it's a progressive loss or lack of appropriate activation of CTLs or formation of CTLs, if you have a in this case, here I'm saying progressive loss because this scenario is more for HIV. Early in the infection, there is no CTL escape because of oligoclonal CTLs. As the infection progresses, the CTLs are being lost. By one of the reasons that I discussed with you before, and at later in the disease, this escape will occur. So this escape, I'm talking a drug resistance virus, will escape and will be synthesized. Okay, and of course, so while the immune system can control and immune response can very nicely control drug resistance, many a times immune system doesn't succeed in controlling infections. So for example, here's the list I just generated. Many infections are controlled by immune response like SARS, smallpox, West Nile virus, and this. Some are partly controlled. I say influenza here because primary infection with influenza can be fatal because of the shortness of the incubation period. There's not enough time for the immune system to take care of that. That's why memory is very important here. But here's the list of these diseases, and there are a whole lot of other diseases which are not controlled by the immune system. So in this case, drug resistance will be very, very common. Okay. Now, HSV-1 and 2, it turns out, is not so common drug resistance in immunocompromised people because there is a phase of, an outcome of any viral infection is either the infected cell is either killed by CTL or killed by the virus, or if it is a retrovirus or herpes virus, it goes through a latency. So this is a mechanism it can stop virus replication and consequently still not have drug resistance. I think this is where I stop. And I'll take any questions.